It's just Marina Rav Shlita. Well, thank you first of all to Joel Perlman, who has suggested this topic. At first I was extremely reluctant because I'm a bit of a coward, and then I thought, well, you know, I can suffer the consequences. If I just say what I have to say honestly, then nobody should hold it against me. But I have appointed a couple of bodyguards to look after me. Norman kindly agreed, and Michael Israel, Henry, you can also be my bodyguards in case. Fine, it's okay. So if I do say anything which upsets you, look, you're perfectly entitled to walk out, but just please don't wake up the person sitting next to you. So thanks to Joel, who I understand Joel works for an organization which is affiliated with the Israeli government. You're an operations manager, is that right?
I'm the COO, since it's being recorded, we're definitely not affiliated with the Israeli government.
Right.
We're a registered charity.
Well, for security purposes, we won't divulge then what Joel is actually doing. But Joel came to me with a question which I had when I was 18 years old and I was in yeshiva, and I asked the similar questions. I've also in my introduction thank Henry Keller, who has lent me some very interesting material on the subject, factual material. This is a very emotive subject. Some people get extremely agitated by it on both sides of the camp, and therefore I can understand why I might say some things which might upset somebody one way or the other way. But what I would stress is that we've arranged a series of at least three of these shiurim, and you won't be able to really get a clear picture of what I'm presenting until you've heard all three. Whereas before, when we've done series like to fill in, you could come to one without coming to the others and you would have a shiur which was separate from the others. In this one, really, each shiur is interdependent on the other, but each one can't be taken in their own context solely. I also think it's pertinent for me to say a bit about my own background on this, because although we don't like to get personal, people, you might suggest, are influenced a bit by things that have happened in their past, and I think a lot of my background is reflective of many people here today. I was educated, as you may know, in the Hasmonean schools, primary and grammar, under the principalship of Rabbi Dr. Solomon Schoenfeld, and the interesting thing which Rabbi Schoenfeld once stood up to say when the school was going to sing the Hatikva, he said, "We want everybody to change the wording of the Hatikva from Lios Amchopshi Barzenu to Lios Am Kodosh Barzenu, that we should be a holy people in our land." Although many translate Chofshi as not meaning free from mitzvahs, as Chofshi, but as independent, as being independent from the persecution of other nations. But a very favorite teacher of mine, Mr. Albert Meyer, Zechronu Livracha, father-in-law of Norman, he was very unhappy about this proposed change to the wording, not because he disagreed with it, but because he said, look, it's not right we start chopping and changing the text of other people's songs, and if we want to sing something different, then we can make up our own songs. But that was his view, which I respected as well. So there are lots of backgrounds you could say, because when my wife asked me, what am I going to talk about? And I said, Zionism. I didn't say nationalism. She said, well, which kind? Is it the original true one, or is it the one where they hijacked the term? And what did she mean by that? It's because one of the things I discussed with Rav Matisho Solomon in Gateshead Yeshiva was about the subject of Zionism. And he said to me, and Rav Matisho Solomon is regarded now as one of the great Gedolei Yisrael, he's the Mashgiach of Lakewood Yeshiva, and he said to me one very interesting idea. He said to me, there is more Zionism in Shir HaMalos B'Shuv Hashem Es Shiva Sion than there is in the Hatikva. Which was a very interesting idea. So my background is, after Hasmonean, I went to Gateshead Yeshiva, which is regarded as what you'd call the Haredi camp. And after Gateshead, much to the surprise of some people, I went to Eretz Yisrael to learn there, and I learnt in a Hesdi yeshiva where some of the boys were the Israeli boys who were doing the army service. So my dialogue with each side of the camp was prevalent, and I try to gain a foothold in understanding the various viewpoints. Certainly, in terms of my family, my ancestors, like many of yours, came from countries of harsh persecution. My mother, Zichrono Levracha, she was the daughter of a well-known teacher in the Hirsch School of Frankfurt am Main. Her father was married to the daughter, her mother was the daughter of Reb Binyamin Falk, who was the headmaster of the Hirsch School, the school founded on the principles of Torah Derech Eretz, on which the modern schools now, like Hasmonean, are really founded according to. So he was a teacher in the Hirsch School. As I will explain later, Rav Hirsch wasn't too happy about nationalism, and I understand that in the early 1920s, when there was a teachers' conference in Frankfurt am Main, and they stood up to start singing the Hatikva, my grandfather walked out in protest. That's a bit about my background. My mother came out from Germany in March 1939, which was very close to the time when they closed the gates in September 39. No one could get out anymore from Nazi Germany. I have a copy of my mother's passport, which has a red J stamped in it. All Jewish people were earmarked as J, and the men were given a middle name of Israel. So my grandfather's name, his name was Mordechai Goldschmidt. He was written down as Mordechai Israel Goldschmidt. And my mother's name was put down as, not just as Bella Pick, there's Bella Sarah Pick. Every woman had the middle name given to them, Sarah. So those Jews who tried to dodge having Jewish names were given Jewish names by the Nazis, Yirach Shemom Zichronom. So the insignia of the swastika is on my mother's passport, my grandmother's passport, my grandfather's passport. And it was very difficult for them to get out from Germany. You needed a visa or something to get to another country. No country would let them in. They wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael, but the British were cutting down on the immigration. They wanted to go to America. They couldn't get the visa and affidavit. In the end, Rabbi Dr. Schoenfeld signed up for the family, and they managed to come over. But their list was confiscated in Holland by the Nazis. So that's my mother's background. My father's background was from Russia, Poland. His mother was born in the East End, but her parents came over from Russia in 1881 when there were many pogroms against Jews. 1881. So my grandmother's parents came over just after they got married. So my grandmother was already conceived in 1881 in Russia, but was born here in London in 1882. That's my father's mother's background. Her mother's parents. My father's father came over from Poland shortly afterwards in the late 1880s because at the age of 15 he faced being thrown into the Russian army, and those who were thrown in the Russian army, the Jewish boys were on the front line, and they didn't get out till the age of 30 if they survived at all. So he came to London as a bocher, aged 15, a teenager, and he lodged with a Frum family in the East End. He became a tailor, a self-employed tailor, because that was the only way he realized he would be able to keep Shabbos. So all the different factions of my family were running away from persecution, were running away from life-threatening styles which they had in their countries of origin. And I think that has a bearing also on some of our attitudes in this subject, because they had nowhere to go to. All right, they came to England, but it was very difficult to come to Eretz Yisrael. So there was this dream, this constant dream about being able to get to Eretz Yisrael, and already, well before Theodor Herzl, who was regarded as the founder of Zionism, there were movements in the 1800s to get to Eretz Yisrael and start living there. In the 1860s, there was founded a movement called Kibbutz Zion, which aimed for at least autonomy in Eretz Yisrael, because the Turkish Ottoman Empire were in control of Eretz Yisrael for many, many years. And they had this dream of founding a Jewish enclave in Eretz Yisrael, which would be run on Jewish lines, on Torah lines, whatever. And they were a movement which started well before Theodor Herzl. Theodor Herzl was an atheist. He knew he was Jewish, but he didn't keep anything. He wasn't a religious man. And he decided, particularly after the Dreyfus affair in France, that the Jews need some solution to the persecution problems which they're suffering. And he felt that the way to solve this problem is by having a Jewish state. And he wrote a pamphlet in 1896 called Der Judenstadt, and he held in 1897 a conference with 200 delegates in the town of Basel, Switzerland, a very special town in my life because that's where I got married, and there is a street in Basel named after him. The locals there are very proud of the fact that that was where the first Zionist Congress took place, and he wanted to address what he called the Jewish question. So his attitude was that Zionism is a political movement which doesn't necessarily have any connections with religion other than the fact that it's for Jews to escape from persecution. Now, we said earlier there may be different definitions of Zionism, because we heard Rav Matisyahu's definition of Zionism, we heard my wife's definition of Zionism, but generally speaking, the idea of Zionism was to create a Jewish state in Palestine, the ancient homeland of the Jews. So you could say that Zionism doesn't really exist anymore because the homeland was created. Now it's done, Zionism was fulfilled. Full stop, end of story. But the question which Joel came to me about was, why is it that we've got these factions of Jewish population, one side which is so much for the idea of the state, and another side so much against the idea of the state? We've got a situation where on the 5th of Iyar, where some Jews are celebrating and saying Hallel, there are certain Jews who are sitting on the floor and saying the Kinnus of Tisha B'Av. Why is it that there are such far-reaching extremes? And that is really the question we want to explore. We're not here to promote any ideology, but to try and understand why is it that we have Jews on one side of the spectrum and on the other side of the spectrum, yet they're both God-fearing Jews. You know, they're both keeping Shabbos and Kashrus and Taras HaMishpacha. Yeah, and you will meet many, what you call the religious Zionist Jews, who are so reductive in every way. And unfortunately, people go by the type of kippah they wear. You can't tell what sort of ideology I have by the sort of kippah I wear. But I once had an American friend who decided to make mockery of the system of the yarmulkes. By one day he wore a black kippah, and the next day he wore a white kippah sruga, and the next day he wore a black kippah. And one Israeli came to him and he said, "Your hashkafas are mixed up." Rabbi Cooper used to say, it doesn't matter what sort of couple you wear, as long as you're learning Torah properly. Anyway, that's by the by. But try and... Yes?
Can I in a sense, it's indisputable we're all Zionists in a different interpretation of the word. We all believe that Eretz Yisrael is where we came from and where we eventually...
Yes, we're davening every day, three times a day, for our return to Eretz Yisrael. But in what context nowadays, before Mashiach, do we view the concept of having a nationalism, of having a state of our own? And really, you could put it into two different categories. You could put it into pre-1948. What were the attitudes prevalent then about the formation of a state? And then, post facto, you've got the emergence of the state in 1948. Do any of these views change? So I'm going to deal primarily today with pre-1948, about the founding of the movement and what the views of Gedolei Yisrael were at that time. Or there were Gedolei Yisrael on both sides of the camp. But we're going to try and understand, in the context of Joel's question, why is it that there was so much antagonism against the idea of having a state in the land of Israel before the time of Mashiach.
There was also a very famous rabbi who changed his mind because of the war.
Yes. Michael Israel kindly referred me not long ago to the Sefer Eimah Bonim Smeicha or Rav Treichsal. I intend to deal with that probably in part two or part three, but not today. But it's a very interesting Sefer, fascinating Sefer. So the person who was really promoting the idea of a Jewish state in Israel, perhaps the first person, was Napoleon. Apparently in 1799 he wanted to found a Jewish state in the land of Israel. But anyway, as we know, things came to a head in the 1890s, but already with Chivat Zion, Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, who is the ideology we follow a lot in our schools nowadays, he wrote about the idea of having a Jewish state already in the 1860s when he wrote his Sefer Chorev. And at the beginning of his Sefer, he writes, he says, "I'm prepared for receiving rebuke, bitter rebuke, and even abuse." But there he was talking in a general context, because he was fighting the reform, and he was trying to promote orthodoxy, and in Germany, things were getting very difficult for the Orthodox. He said, "I'm not afraid of the battle." And we can use his words, perhaps, for myself now. I'm not afraid of the battle if anybody's going to try shooting me. We didn't have any security restrictions in coming here today, but I'm hoping that I will become unscathed when I walk out from here. But Rabbi Hirsch wrote in his Sefer Chorev on page 460 about the duties of the subject and the citizen, praying for the welfare of the state in which one lives and keeping to the laws of the state in which one lives. But he says,
is that the original or the translation?
This is a photocopy of the English version, translated by Diane Grunfeld, the grandfather of Rabbi Kohnschleser. So I do have, if you want, the original Gothic German version.
To get to that point.
Very difficult. Even my wife can't understand it, and German is her mother tongue, because it's in such a high, difficult German.
Okay.
Yeah. He says, "Whichever land Jews shall live in as citizens, as inhabitants, and enjoying special protection, they shall honour and love the princes and government as their own. Contribute with every possible power to their good." So he was talking about loyalty to king and country in amazing ways. But let's look at some of the words he said, and I'm going to read out verbatim what he wrote. "We take to heart the harshness which we have encountered in our years of wandering as the chastisement of a father imposed on us for improvement. And we mourn the lack of observance." And he says just earlier, when it comes to the idea of a state, "The possession of the land and the ensuing organization of the state was for Israel not an end, but a means." So the idea of having a country of Eretz Yisrael was never an end in itself. It was a means to an end for the better fulfillment of their Jewish duties. "The Torah did not exist for the state, but the state for the Torah. And only the Torah, the idea of being joint bearers of a spiritual calling, fused the individuals into an association of human beings, which gave us the term a people, or the term goy, a corporate body or a people." And then he said, "But this very vocation obliges us, until God shall call us back to the Holy Land, to live and to work as patriots wherever he has placed us." So he was saying, let's be duty bound towards Germany or whichever country in which we live, to collect all the physical, material and spiritual forces, and that is noble to Israel, to further the will of the nations which has given us shelter. And it obliges us further to allow our longing for the far off land to express itself only in mourning, in wishing and hoping. He was saying, we pray for returning one day to Eretz Yisrael, and only through the honest fulfillment of all Jewish duties to await the realization of this hope. But then he says, but it forbids us to strive for the reunion or the possession of the land by any but spiritual means. The way we will get Eretz Yisrael back will be through our adherence to the Torah and the mitzvahs. And this was seen as a direct attack to the Chibat Zion movement, which was in fact supported by one or two well-known Rabbonim. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalisha was one who wrote Drishas Zion, and the two of them were rather opposed to the views of each other. Rabbi Hirsch was saying it will only be by spiritual means that we get back Eretz Yisrael, and we can daven for it, but that's all we can do. And then he says, our sages say God imposed three vows when he sent Israel into the wilderness. And this is a crucial concept which we have to refer a few times through this series. And that is what is called the three oaths. What are the three oaths? So in the Gemara Ksuva, Daf Kuf Yud Aleph, Amud Aleph, it says there that in preparing for the future, when the Jews will be in exile, God made the Jewish people swear. The Omar Gimel Shuas Halolu, what are they? Achas Shalo Yalu Yisrael Bechoma. That the Jews will not come to Eretz Yisrael Bechoma up a wall. What does it mean, up a wall? So Rashi says, Yachad, all the Jews coming together the Yad Chazoka, in force. So the view is that the Jewish people made an oath with HaKadosh Baruch Hu that they will accept Eretz Yisrael when it's given to them, but they will not come along and attack it by force in order to attain it for themselves. That they will not rebel, the Jews will not rebel against the other peoples of the world, and that they will tacitly accept what is due to them, because that is part of the punishment of exile.
How would that fit with the fact that the UN gave Israel?
That's really our climax, isn't it? I will.
You've given away the answer.
You've given away the answer. Let me just finish talking about the three O's. V'achas yishpi HaKadosh Baruch Hu es ha'ovdei kochovim shlei yishavdu bohen Yisrael yoseh midai. That the other peoples of the world shall not persecute the Jews yoseh midai, more than enough. Well, nothing for us really is enough. We don't want any persecution, but unduly persecute the Jews they shall not do. Now, Michael Israel just referred to the Eim HaBonim Smeicha, Rav Treichtal, and in his view he said, because the peoples of the world did persecute us more than Yoseh Midai, a country which built gas ovens specially to kill Jews en masse, never before in Jewish history has such a thing had ever happened, that 10,000 Jews a day were being killed in Auschwitz alone. So according to Rav Treichtal, he said, since the non-Jews did not keep to their oath, therefore the other oaths fall apart. But that's really for us to discuss in more detail at a later stage. But these are the three oaths which are quoted by Rav Hirsch. I will come later to the Rav Meir Simchov Devinsk, who addressed the idea of the San Remo Conference in 1920, the League of Nations in 1922. But these are the oaths. And Rav Hirsch is talking in the 1860s. When these amazing events had not yet happened. So he quotes these oaths, and he puts them here in English. The children of Israel shall never seek to re-establish their nation by themselves, but they shall never be disloyal to the nations which have given them shelter, and that these nations shall not oppress them excessively. The fulfillment of the first two vows is confirmed in the pages of history. About the third, the nations concerned must judge themselves. And there is a footnote given by Ryan Grunfeld, who translated this, referring us to the subject of Tzom Gedalia, where also in Chorev he discusses the idea that Gedalia was the Jew who was looking after the welfare of the nations in honouring them, and it was the Jewish rebels who killed him to try and go against, and as a result we had this terrible tragedy. And there, Dag Grunfeld refers to the famous Talmudical passage in Kesubos, where we got the three oaths, but nevertheless, it doesn't mean that Hirsch was in favour of a quietism. He spoke very strongly. He was a member of parliament, Rabbi Hirsch, in Moldova, and he spoke in big defence of the Jews on many issues, and he was not what some people would call a quietist. So that's Rav Hirsch. Yes?
And he might add, he has no objection to people, Jews, especially.
He wrote, he's not objecting to individuals going and living in Eretz Yisrael. But collectively, he didn't see that as an ideology. He wrote some tshuvas in a sefer called Shemesh Umarpei. I've got a photocopy of some extracts of it, where he was criticizing the Chibat Zion movement. Apparently Rav Svihesh Kalisha wrote him three times asking for his support for raising money for the Yishuv, and Rabbi Hirsch was not very supportive.
I'm sure he raised money for people living in Eretz Israel.
Whether he raised money or not, I didn't come across that. But he said, Rav Hirsch says they never approach redemption through improvement of the Holy Land. He said their objective is to live in Israel, but our predominant objective is the keeping of the Torah. And only through improvement of our hearts and souls will we succeed. There were others, Rav Chanan Wasserman, who sadly was killed by the Nazis. He wrote a sefer, Omer Ani Maaseh LaMelech, and he said Zionism is a secular ideology. It doesn't go according to the Torah. So in that respect, since it's an ideology different to the Torah, it's a form of idolatry. He said, the Zionists, he said, are saying, let's be like the Gentiles. Let's be like the other peoples of the world. They mean to act for our benefit, but in doing so, they are acting harmfully and dangerous, because whenever we've forsaken the Torah, that's the times when we got into trouble. And those are the times when we were persecuted by the Jew haters, when we were not keeping to the Torah. Hakal kol Yaakov, ayodayim yaday Esav. If we are light in keeping with the voice of Yaakov, with the Torah, then you get Esav coming, irrespective of whether you have a state or not. This was the approach taken by Rav Chanan Wasserman, and he said, you know, there is a problem here with this ideology, because in Ikvasot de Mashiach, he writes, people are asking Shilas about whether they're saying Kaddish now or whether they're saying Kaddish another time. He said, the real Shilas, the real questions which have become political, have been removed from the Torah and have been given to politicians and journalists and have been taken away from the rabbis. Another well-known rabbi, who might surprise you in me quoting, was the chief rabbi of England. Rabbi Naftali or Hermann Adler was the chief rabbi of England in 1899, just when the Zionist Congress had taken place. And you might think that the chief rabbinate of the United Synagogue would have adopted a more, how shall I say, flexible and kindly approach to the Zionism movement. But listen to his words. He said, my brothers, I look at this movement with worry in my heart, since I see it as opposed to the Torah of Hashem. There is great danger in it. They ask me, if you are opposed to the idea of a Jewish state, and you don't believe in settling millions of Jews in the Holy Land, how is this consistent with all the prayers in which we express our hope for our return to Zion? He said, I reply, the books of the prophets do not say that the return to Zion depends on our efforts. It is stated explicitly that our redemption will come by the hand of Hashem. Whenever he decides to send us his Mashiach, then all the nations will bring back our scattered brethren to the land of our fathers. And then he refers to the three oaths. Hashem made three oaths not to force the end before its time. So the idea of the oath has been seen by many Gedolei Yisrael as to try to force the Mashiach to come, as to force the Geulah and redemption. So, although in one aspect you'll say, well, we're still in Golus, we are, whether you're in Israel or outside Israel, we're still in Golus. But the feeling which was prevalent at that time was that there were Jews who were trying to force a redemption. He said, we must wait silently for the day when the words of the prophet will be fulfilled, and only to wait without taking any action. So were the words written by the chief rabbi of England, Rabbi Hermann Adler. And famous also was Shemesh Shmuel, Rav Shmuel Bornstein. In 1917 he was around. He was the son of the Avnei Nezer. And he spoke about the Pasuk, Ve'ele Shemos B'nei Yisrael, Haboy Mitzrayim, Ace Yaakov, Ishuvei Tobo. So he asked, why is it the Pasuk you've got the name both Yisrael and Yaakov, referring to Jacob? And he said, Yaakov denotes the Jew in exile, who must lower himself, who must bow and scrape before the Gentiles, just as Yaakov bowed before Esav and called him my master, so we have to accept our exile as for what is determined on us. And he quotes the Kuzari in 3:12, who says, a Jew who endures the exile and who complains loses a share in Olam Haba. A Jew's job is to accept the exile which is placed on him. And he says, this is the opposite of the well-known movement, he doesn't say the Zionist movement, of the well-known movement who cannot bear exile and want to develop an ideology in the land. Now, a lot of people will say, well, the three oaths are written here in the Gemara as a form of Agadatah. It's not brought down to Halacha in Rambam, in Shulchan Aruch, in Poskim. So, therefore, do we regard the three oaths as something important or not? However, the Rambam, although he codified Halacha, the Rambam in his Egeris Temon does refer to these three oaths. and he's addressing Jews in the Yemen who had this aspiration to come to Eretz Yisrael, and he said, look, Shlomo knew that this nation, when sunk in Ezal, will try and arouse itself, not at its proper time, because the oaths come from a pasuk in Shir HaShirim, talking about Benos Yerushalayim, which is the Jewish people, and the Baalei HaTosfos write that this is an illusion. Hashem warned against the coming close to Mount Sinai, and this is an allusion to not try to force redemption, and anyone who speeds it up will not survive. No doubt the Yishuv was a great mitzvah, said the Rashbash in 1400s. He says, but during the exile, it's not for all the Jews. There is a plan God has to scatter the Jews all over the world, because that's the way the Jews survive. The Jew haters can't get at us if we're scattered around the world. He says, see what happened to the Bnei Ephraim when they hurried the end of the exile in Egypt. So he said, there is a mitzvah for individuals to live in Israel, but not collectively, and not if obstacles stand in your way.
You need to save your life, like those in Russia.
Well, we'll come to that question. The fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe, whose yahrzeit is today, the 2nd of Nisan, his name was Rav Sholem Dovber, or spelt as Dovber, but Dovber. He wrote in 1899, when this all came to a climax with the movement, he said, this is an anti-Mashiach movement. He said, it's forcing the end of the exile. And he said, even excessive prayers, even if you daven much more than you normally daven, you shouldn't do that to try and hasten the end of our redemption, because things will take their course, and it's our duty to be passive. And he wrote in a collection of essays of a Sefer Olai Yeshorim in the year 1900 many wrote against the Zionist movement in that Sefer, but he put the emphasis on messianism is not something which we can rush, it's not something which we can hasten. An interesting concept, because as we've got the Lubavitch movement, perhaps nowadays, is stressing messianism more than some others, but they're not saying we have to force it. What they're saying is, we keep our mitzvahs, and if we keep our mitzvahs, that will help to bring Mashiach more quickly, which is a view which is not only a view of Lubavitch, but of everybody. The Minchas Elozar, a very famous Rav in Hungary, Rav Chaim Elozar Spira, came from Munkacs, and he was perhaps one of the most fiercest antagonists against the Zionist movement when it was coming at that time. He said something very interesting. He said, since the Zionists have made the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael their ideology, that they're claiming it's a mitzvah to live in the land, therefore, since they are a secular movement, we should not do it. He was even saying that you're setting aside the mitzvah. He compares it to the one stone altar, the matseva, used by the Ovis. When the Ovis used this matseva for their offerings, that same matseva later became forbidden. Why? Because it was used by idolaters. So since it was used by idolaters, that disqualified it. He refers to a Russian Devarim, chapter 16, verse 22. So his view was that, but since the Zionists, who are secular ideology, took hold of this idea of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, he said that turned it into something which we should not do. That was the view of the Minchas Elozar. And he organized a gathering in the year 1922 in a place called Ksap in Slovakia against not just the Zionist movement, but against the Aguda movement. Because the Aguda movement were sympathetic to the idea of the Yishuv, but he was against them as well. He criticized their approach to yeshiva education, to their approach to Eretz Yisrael. He accused them of collaborating with the Zionists. He said they are influenced by secular learning and exposed to German neo-orthodoxy, which I find quite amusing, because one of his best Talmidim was somebody who became the Shopron HaRov in New York, whose brother was Dine Eliezer Posen, who was married to my grandmother's sister. Dine Posen was the Dine on Kadassia here, and was the very Yekish Dine, but his brother learnt in Munkacs under the Minchas Elozar, and he became very Hasidish. And when they were thinking of appointing him as being the Shopron HaRov in New York, there were some who said, no, we mustn't take him, because he went to college when he was in Germany. And it was the Minchas Elozar, Rav Chaim Elozar Spira, who said, look, don't worry, he's a good leader for you. You take him. Don't worry about the fact that he was in college in Germany. And the biggest supporter of the Munkacharov was Rav Yoel Moshe Teitelbaum, later who became known as the Satzma Rebbe. The Satzma Rav. He lived from 1887 till 1979. So he was actually living through the Six-Day War and the Yom Kippur War. And he wrote a sefer called Vayol Moshe, which I have a copy of, and anyone who wants can look at it. And he set out, in his view, what the Torah approach is to this subject. We don't have a lot of time, but he predicted the downfall of what he called the heretical kingdom as a necessary precondition for redemption. He said divine mercy will be needed, that it will fall by divine means, because he said, I don't want anybody to get hurt. I don't want Jewish people to be killed in this. And there is a great danger. He says, in 1967, we have no choice but to pray for the Jewish people and for their lives, that they'd not be devoured. And not meet a horrible end, God forbid. But he said, I've got no concern for the sovereign Jewish state, which he called the Tower of Babel erected by Zionists. That was the view of the Satzma Rav. I was going to talk a bit about the Chazanish, but I think I might leave that till next time. And there was an interesting meeting which took place between David Ben-Gurion, Prime Minister of Israel, in the early 1950s, and the Chazanish. Ben-Gurion was worried about how he's going to manage running the state if girls can't be called up to the army. That was the reason for the meeting, although there were the issues of Yeshiva Brochim as well. I think we've got a few minutes, so we'll end up with the Chazon Ish and then maybe say something about Rav Meir Simcha of Divinsk before we conclude for today. The Chazon Ish came to Ben-Gurion, who had no official standing, but the Chazon Ish was regarded as the Posek Hador. And when the idea came out that girls should be called up to do army service, the Chazon Ish didn't simply say that girls may not be called up. He actually said, Yarod Valyavo. He said, this is a matter of life and death, that the girls should be willing to give up their lives. He saw it as striking at the whole fabric of the Kedusha of the Jewish people. So Ben-Gurion came along and tried to put his case. You can imagine how many newspaper photographers were surrounding the place. What an excitement there was, because this was one of the most amazing dialogues in recent Jewish history. And the Chazon Ish said to Ben-Gurion, he quoted him a Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Lamed Beis Amud Beis. And he said to him, look, if you've got two camels... Sorry, did I say it the other way around? The Chazon Ish said to Ben-Gurion, there's a Gemara in Sanhedrin. He said, if you've got two camels going up to the top of a hill, I'll read out to you the words of the Gemara. So they're coming up some steep hill and they can't pass each other. If they pass each other, they'll both fall down the steep slope. But if one waits for the other, then they'll both manage to get past. So what does the Gemara say? Which camel goes first? The one which is laden with heavy goods. The camel with the heavy goods on its back, that gets priority, that goes first. And the man that's not laden, which has to wait for the other one. He said, we are the camel with the load on our back. We have the Torah for the last 3,000 years. That is the load on our back. So we get priority over you. So we get precedence, and then you can pass through as the other camel. So Ben-Gurion answered to the Chazon Ish, our camel is also laden. We're bringing people in to settle the land, which is a mitzvah. We're defending lives. Our boys are on the border protecting. That's not a mitzvah. We've also got a load on the camel's back. So the Chazon Ish said, it's only thanks to learning Torah that your soldiers exist. And by virtue of the learning of Torah, the state is surviving. Because of us, you can do everything that you're doing. But the Torah is Eitz Chaim Hi. That is the source of life. Now, they spoke in a very friendly tone with each other. In fact, Ben-Gurion afterwards said that the Chazon Ish, he possessed a face and eyes of a very spiritual man. And the Chazon Ish said about Ben-Gurion, he's got a neshama gedola, he's got a great soul. But their dialogue, so Ben-Gurion said to the Chazon Ish, should not the love of Israel take precedence? Chazon Ish said, the love of Israel and Torah are not separate. There is no Torah without Israel, and there's no Israel without Torah. And the Chazon Ish said to Ben-Gurion, if you stop boys learning in yeshiva, the state of Israel will not last for three more days. That was the dialogue. So there was no giving in there. Interesting story and dialogue between the two. I want to finish off today with Rav Meir Simcha.
There was a biography printed on the Chazon Ish in 6 volumes. The first 5 volumes were printed by one printer. The 6th volume was all about Chazon Ish's relationship with Ben-Gurion and others. The printer refused to print it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it was printed by a different printer.
Yes.
But Rabbi Cooper had the whole set.
Oh.
Yeah, because it was given to him by a nephew. But that's Ad Kedei Kach. People didn't accept that the Chazon Ish had done the right thing.
Very interesting. Thank you. So one Rav I'm going to quote, a very famous Godel, Rav Meir Simcha Cohen of Dvinsk. He's well known for the Sefer Meshech Chochmo, and he also wrote a very classic Perush on the Rambam called Osamayach. He lived in Lithuania and Latvia between 1843 and he died in 1926. And he was very excited at the San Remo conference, which took place in 1920, which you mentioned earlier. And he said, this negates the oaths, the 3 oaths. The peoples of the world have endorsed the land of Israel for the Jews. And he said, the Zionists are performing, when we say Kaddish, we say the word Yisgadal, of making great. The Zionists are actualizing the concept of Yisgadal, and eventually the Jewish people will achieve the next word, the Yisgadash, and it shall be made holy. That was, in essence, Rav Meir Simcha Cohen of Dvinsk, and we'll deal with him in more detail in our next part of the series. Thank you very much. I'm grateful for no tomato having been thrown, and I'm still surviving.
What was the San Remo meeting?
San Remo was a conference in Italy.
Okay.
It was really 4 countries. It was basically what happened was the Turkish Ottoman Empire fell in the First World War, which finished in 1918. And so the whole Ottoman Empire, having collapsed, was up for grabs. So the nations of the world took it together to decide what should happen to the Ottoman Empire. There were 4 countries which met at San Remo. I think Britain, France, Italy, and I think Japan. But that was followed 2 years later by the League of Nations, which was the forerunner of the United Nations, which was all the countries of the world which endorsed the land of Israel being for the Jewish people. And I propose in our next year to bring maps with to show what was discussed at San Remo and at the League of Nations, and of course the endorsement of the United Nations in 1948, yeah, as to what happened then. So that's really our next part of the series.
Is anybody
used to say Kaddish? Oh, yeah.